and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and joining me today is Georgia-based author Jonathan Maxwell. Jonathan holds a BA in English from Berry College in Rome, Georgia, along with a minor in psychology. He also possesses a paralegal certificate from North Metro Technical College in Acworth, Georgia. His new book, Murderous Intellectuals, Germans Elite and the Nazi LSS, sorry, let me start that again, Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites and the Nazi SS, has just been published and can be found at pdbookstore.com, amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and Books in Print. Jonathan also has a second book in the works, scheduled for a 2010 release, titled Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes. It's a lighthearted examination of scientific frauds through history. His publisher is American Book Publishing, which is based in Salt Lake City. And as mentioned, his publisher's book website is pdbookstore.com. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, great. So you have really put out a very interesting and unique book. It's filling a niche that there are not a lot of books on shelves today, really talking about the individuals of the whole Nazi Party. You know, you're really putting a spotlight on specific individuals, bringing readers some of the more lesser understood aspects of their personal psyche. And I'm interested in this new term you've coined, desk murderers, and really what the motivation was for you to put this book out.
Well, for starters, I've been interested in the Holocaust for most of my life. I'm not even sure why. My fascination with the subject began when I was only a little boy, around 10 or 11 or so. At times, I would see old footage of the Nazi camps like Treblinka or Auschwitz, and obviously, I was always very horrified by the footage. Nevertheless, I also wanted to know how such a horrible thing happened. I then began to research the subject extensively. During the course of my research, I read many fine books about the subject, but through the years, I noticed that there was a dearth of information in one key area. All people know that the Nazi leaders were evil, but few people realize that many, if not most, of these leaders were actually very well educated and often hailed from comfortable, even affluent, social backgrounds. The Nazi Party, in fact, was full of doctors, lawyers, professors, scientists, engineers, and other highly trained, highly valued professionals. What was frustrating for me was that a lot of books alluded to this fact, that the National Socialist Party was full of intellectuals, but no books were written about this topic. Eventually, I became so frustrated that I decided to write the book myself. After all, I had a degree in English. The topic was fascinating to me, and at the time, I guess you could say I've been a victim of the economy. I'd been laid off and had plenty of time on my hands.
So what were some of the big questions then that you were really wanting to answer with this book to alleviate that frustration and really present new information to the public?
Well, like I said, I think it's an under-researched topic. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very surprising how many intellectuals were in the Nazi Party. Initially, I was only going to concentrate on about 10 or so Nazi leaders, but the more research I did, the more I realized that wouldn't be enough. There were actually thousands of Nazi intellectuals, and I felt that their stories need to be told as well. I suppose that Dr. Josef Mengele was the most famous Nazi intellectual, but, you know, obviously there were many others. One such Nazi intellectual was Otto Ohlendorf. This man commanded a death squad out in the Ukraine following the German invasion of the Soviet Union. Over 6 months or so, this squad shot about 100,000 persons, most of them Jews. Now, Ohlendorf, he sounds like a brute, but actually he was superbly educated. He held doctorates in both law and economics. Another death squad commander was Oscar Dollwanger. He was one of the most brutal of Nazi leaders. He held a doctorate in political science. And another thing, well, the Nazi scientists included two men who had actually won Nobel Prizes. One was Johann Stark, and the other one was Philippe Lenard. The Nazi SS, the organization that ran the death camps, this was in many ways an elitist group. One-third of SS officers had college degrees. This was at a time when only a tiny percentage of people in Europe had any sort of college training.
So what do you attribute the fact that these were very highly intelligent people, and really scientists, lawyers, physicians, physicists? How do you think it is that these seemingly intelligent people could have really consciously committed such unbelievable atrocities? I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of people think that they were just out-and-out psychopaths, but it really isn't quite that simple.
No, it isn't. My findings, in fact, seem to imply that education and intelligence don't necessarily equate with good moral behavior. Western society has long held this view that the more educated you are, the more rational you are. The Western societies in Europe, here in America, in Australia, we tend to feel that smart people are elites, the so-called best and brightest. My findings tend to show that such ideas are fallacious, or at least simplistic to a considerable degree. If anything, the intelligence levels of these SS officers allowed them to have more influence with regular people. Average persons naturally assume that these well-educated, accomplished leaders must have been correct when they said that Jews and Slavs were subhumans, among other things. Their intelligence levels allow them to commit murder on a massive scale.
And so how was it that they had such influence? I know you go into education in your book, and how it like the German education system, and how it really helped to mold the mindset of the whole Nazi state. So I'm interested in how, what type of education and how that actually happened. And you really kind of go into this in your book, in the whole chapter of the autocratic nature of German society.
Well, for one thing, I found that diplomas, they don't always prove that persons are intelligent or moral. Ultimately, what matters is what students are taught and how they are taught. Ironically, traditional German education actually helped, in my view, to bring on the Nazi state. Traditional German schools downplayed individualism and critical thinking. Instead, they emphasized rote memorization. The schools pushed propaganda, like insisting that German culture was superior to all other cultures. Finally, these schools were very authoritarian, and sometimes teachers physically brutalized their own terrified students. This was an everyday affair. These ideas, they're nearly identical with basic Nazi precepts. Thus, it shouldn't be surprising that fascism developed in this traditionally authoritarian society.
How long do you think it took that fascism to really become ingrained in that society?
Actually, I think it was hundreds of years in the making. It's not just a German problem. I think it's a problem with Western culture in and of itself. I'm afraid that Western culture is not a very nurturing culture. It's a very hard-nosed culture. Western society, they don't believe that people should be loved or nurtured. Personally, I wish that Western culture could learn from, like, maybe the Samoans or the tribal cultures of Central Africa. These cultures, they generally are very nurturing. They're very individualistic. Everybody has a fair amount of equality with one another. And I think we actually have a lot to learn from those primitive cultures. I think that Western culture, there's a very hard-nosed aspect of it that has really facilitated both oppression and even genocide.
So with research that you've done over the years, and then the research that you did to prepare for writing this book, what did you come up with what happened before Nazi Germany in other areas that may have been, little crumbs that have led to the fact that this atrocity could have happened? Is there any way that we can look back to civilizations or societies prior so we could never have this happen again?
Well, for one thing, and again, this is just a German problem. It was a problem throughout Europe. There was a very long, long history of anti-Semitism. Most Gentiles in Europe, they despised Jews. They had very little tolerance for them. They were made a scapegoat, and this wasn't strictly a German problem. The only thing that made Germany unique was that after World War I ended, obviously Germany was defeated. It was devastated by the war. And the Germans, they didn't feel good about themselves. They felt like they had been used and oppressed, and so severely so that they began to look for scapegoats. And Jews seemed to be the ultimate scapegoats. Culturally, they were different. Religiously, they were different. Many Germans, like most Gentile Europeans, they just felt like that the Jews did not belong. And this was just hundreds and hundreds of years in the making.
Mm. Now, when they started, from what I understand, I think I read this in your book, actually, when they started with the death camps, it wasn't necessarily just for the Jews, right? It was for everyone it was part of the German society that was actually being meant for the initial death camps.
Yes, the first people who were actually gassed, and most people I don't think realize this, it was actually German citizens. Because Hitler and the Nazis, they despised the sick, the old, the handicapped. Hitler and the Nazi leaders, they wanted a nation of soldiers. And obviously the sick, the weak, they didn't fit in with that mindset. And so people who had mental disabilities, the physically handicapped, even otherwise normal individuals who suffered from mental disorders like clinical depression or bipolar disorder, they were shipped to so-called clinics where they were gassed. It didn't start with the Jews. It actually started with German citizens. And hundreds of thousands of people died in this way. I think something that's especially horrible is that so many people were gassed for some really flimsy reasons. Again, people who had bipolar disorder were gassed. People who suffered from clinical depression were gassed. It's a very horrifying thought. Think of all the mentally ill people that exist today. Hundreds of thousands of people in America alone depend on such drugs as lithium or Prozac to control their mental illnesses. In Germany, there was no recourse. You would be gassed.
So do you think, Jonathan, from what you've read, I mean, you have years and years into this subject matter. Do you think that anything like this could happen today, or do you think we've sufficiently learned from what happened in Germany?
Well, after World War II, people shouted out never again, saying that no one would be, no other genocide would be tolerated by the international community. But that has not happened. It has happened since, and more than once. There was a genocide in Cambodia during the late 1970s and the early 1980s, and virtually nothing was done to stop it. The UN didn't respond. The Americans didn't respond. Nobody did. And I think the death toll for that was about 3 or 4 million people. And Rwanda, the genocide in Rwanda was especially severe. I think over the course of 9 or 10 months, about 800,000 people were annihilated. You know, the oppressors there were almost as efficient as the Nazis were. And there was also another genocide being carried out in the former Yugoslavia. Now, luckily, America and the UN did respond to that. So even though it was a terrible situation, it was stopped decisively. But that tends to be the exception rather than the rule. Right now, there's probably genocidal activities being carried out in Tibet. The Chinese government is oppressing the Tibetans. And again, the response from the international community has been at best anemic. We vowed never again, you know, another Holocaust will not be allowed to happen, but it has happened again more than once.
Why do you think this is still going on?
Sometimes, and I know it's a very gloomy outlook, sometimes, and I do address this in my book, sometimes I do feel that human beings are hardwired to hate one another.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. I'm talking today with Jonathan Maxwell. His book, Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites and the Nazi SS, is available now, and you can find it all over the web and also through Jonathan's publishing website, pdbookstore.com. Can you talk about the whole genetic aspect of this? It's so fascinating. Yes, please go on.
Some scientists have alleged that perhaps there is a violence gene. I really do think that eventually science will actually locate this gene. But that being said, I do think there's hope for humanity. I think that in Western society, anyway, alone, I do think that people have finally grown weary of hatred because they realize the horrible effects that have happened just because of racial and ethnic hatred. you know, the Holocaust provided a useful lesson. And the situation here in America, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., that provided a useful lesson. I think Westerners, they're finally realizing that love, or at least acceptance, tends to be far better than hatred.
And violence, for sure. Do you think it will be basically the masses taking a collective responsibility that will change the course of this violent history that we have?
Yes, I do. I think people are, their mindsets are slowly evolving. And I do think that in Western society, at least, we are renouncing violence. And obviously that's a very helpful, obviously that's a good thing. And we can be hopeful in that respect, certainly. That being said, if, you know, absolutely, maybe not in Western culture, but elsewhere, notably the Middle East, there's still a lot of war and bloodshed going on. And so we should never forget about that. Violence just seems to be an ongoing thing. And I think one of the reasons why there's so much violence and bloodshed in the Middle East is because, frankly, about Western exploitation. And thanks to Western exploitation, many people in those countries feel, you know, certainly oppressed. And because of that lack of stability, you know, another Holocaust could happen. Anywhere where you find poverty, social inequality, you know, these very sad actualities of life, there's always a potential for genocide.
That's really frightening because, you know, you talk about Western exploitation. That is going on worldwide in many, many areas. So, you know, really this could just be the tip of the iceberg at this point.
Sure, sure. And things could always get worse,
mm-hmm.
Certainly. So I think in such a respect, human beings really need to start treating each other better. Because in the long run, that's good for all societies involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm really interested in your conclusions that you draw out of your book. And in the first line, actually, in your chapter of conclusions, you say that the Nazi elites were motivated by simple evil, seduced by the forces of greed, the desires for stature and fear. Particularly, I'd like for you to comment on the idea of the motivation by simple evil, and really what it is you're talking about when you talk about evil, because you mentioned that quite a bit in your book.
Well, I think that the Nazi leaders, they were actually motivated by very mundane, universal reasons. A lot of the Nazi elites, perhaps even most of them, they knew that the Aryan master race thing was a ridiculous idea. They knew that Aryan blood was no different from Jewish blood or Russian blood. I think what motivated these people was just the search for power and perhaps greed. And you see this seems to be prevalent in all of the Nazi elites. They wanted to rule over other people, and they wanted to make good money. And there was a lot of money to be made in the SS, because when the Jews were, you know, expelled from Germany, the SS leaders, they got their homes, their possessions, their furniture, their clothes, and they even assumed their businesses. There was a lot of money to be made in the Nazi SS during the 1920s and the 1930s, and perhaps even into the mid 40s. the Nazi Party in Europe was the easiest way to achieve wealth and power.
Do you think that this could actually happen in a capitalist society, a democratic society?
Well, Germany had a democratic society. In fact, the Hitler, he was appointed chancellor through perfectly legal means. The Nazis, thanks to their organizational efforts, they received a majority of votes, and the Nazis were thrust into power. But the Nazis, they became powerful through perfectly legal means.
So this really, I mean, this could happen anywhere. This could happen on the soil that you and I stand on.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Especially when you talk about motivated by power and greed. I mean, we're kind of seeing that come to a head here in our own country.
Oh, sure. It's a problem that persisted in all, basically in all nations. There's always going to be a group of people who are just so blindly ambitious. They want wealth, they want power, they want status. And if they have to step over some toes, they're going to be perfectly willing to do that. And let's not forget that Germany at the time was one of the most advanced nations in the world. I mean, they basically epitomized civilization. But look what happened in their culture.
And the downfall was quite quick.
Sure. We can feel thankful for that, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
Sure.
So was there anything in your research and in writing this book, Jonathan, that really astounded you, that you did not know before going into this project, that you really wanted to make sure you got into this book?
One of the things that I found most horrifying was that the Nazi SS, they had their own training centers for mass murder. Before staff members went out to the death camps, like Belzec and Treblinka, they were trained at a quote-unquote medical facility, but instead of learning how to save lives, they were taught how to destroy life. They were instructed on how to operate the gas chambers. They were taught basic human physiology, you know, what was required to kill a living person. They learned how long that they needed to see how long it took a person to die. How quickly to go into the gas chamber itself to pick up the bodies and cremate them. Yeah, I mean, it was just all very, very organized.
That is incredible. Do you think that was more of a test to see who had it in this elite group that could really go on to actually do that to people? Was it a weeding out center, or did everyone basically have that disconnect where they at that point could do that to another human being?
Most people did very, very well. It didn't seem to bother them psychologically all that much.
Isn't that amazing? I find that so just so hard to believe. And I know that you've studied a lot about psychology. I mean, it is one of your degrees. How do you make sense of that?
Well, for one thing, if your government tells you to do something, generally you're going to do it because you regard them as being a legitimate governing body. And this was always a problem in Germany. People essentially did what they were told. They felt like they had an obligation to satisfy the needs of their government. So when Hitler ordered the Holocaust, the average citizen just complied with the order.
Just incredible.
Now, at the medical facilities like Harsheim, there were a few people who who could not take it psychologically or had moral qualms about what they were being instructed to do. Those individuals were basically sent to a suicide squads, basically where they would not be able to survive, like out in the Russian front, or in the southern European areas, like Yugoslavia, where especially fierce fighting was going on. But generally, there weren't too many individuals like that. Most people, they just did their jobs, and some even seemed to enjoy their work.
Enjoy it. That's incredible. Yeah, it sounds like they pretty much knew what the repercussions would be if they didn't follow, so of course they did.
Yes, but one thing that we have to remember is that the SS didn't really need to threaten people all that much. Generally, the SS attracted and maintained recruits just because that being in the SS had so many benefits. Like the individuals who worked in the camps themselves, in a lot of ways they actually had it lucky. They had above average pay. Not only did they have adequate food, but they had especially good food, and they received a lot of it. You know, regular German soldiers out on the Russian front, they ate poorly. Their uniforms were full of holes. They stayed cold. This wasn't the situation at the death camps. Like I said, they enjoyed better food. They had adequate uniforms. They received a lot of clothes from the government. They were given generous leaves. And
social status, too.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. And they were even given unlimited quantities of free alcohol.
Really?
Yes. Actually, that became a big problem.
Alcoholism.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
I imagine so. Was that addressed in the hierarchy, or was that just accepted?
Well, the governing elite tried to do something about it, but the problem was just so prevalent that really and truly nothing could be done about it. I mean, it was just systemic within the entire SS system. The problem was that people found their jobs to be so horrifying that they turned to alcohol. I addressed the soldiers who were in the task forces, which rounded up Jews and shot them and buried them in mass graves. Alcoholism was especially common there because of the close contact they had with victims. So otherwise, what happened was these soldiers, these executioners, to perform their duties, they consumed a lot of alcohol beforehand, or they drank heavily after finishing their tasks, just because they found their jobs to be so horrifying. But you know what? They did them anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Was there any drug addiction, or was it mostly alcohol?
Alcohol was the primary culprit, but a number of German elites, Nazi elites, had problems with morphine.
Mm.
Like Hermann Göring, Hitler's right-hand man, he was a notorious morphine addict. And there's a lot of speculation that Hitler himself used a lot of drugs. And obviously that made him even more mentally unstable.
Right. How fascinating. This must have been a very, very interesting project for you to work on, Jonathan. Will you be writing more along the lines of the Nazi elite?
I'm considering it. Right now, I'm currently writing about more positive topics.
Good for you.
This is
weighty, very heavy.
Oh, absolutely. But it's been a very rewarding project.
And so what else are you working on? I mentioned earlier that you're a book in 2010, Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes.
Yes, that's mainly about the missing link. Scientists during the early 1900s thought that they had found the quote-unquote missing link, Piltdown Man, but that was actually proven to be a hoax. And I address other hoaxes as well, like lake monsters, Bigfoot, UFO abductions, just something light and entertaining to read.
That's fantastic. And so I think you have another project in the go, too.
Yes, it's about the Rolling Stones' disastrous 1969 tour. The name of the book is Tragedy at Altamont, or A Tale Concerning the Rolling Stones, The Hell's Angels, Death, and Sympathy for the Devil. And I finished the book. I haven't received a contract for it yet, but I'm very optimistic. I'm very proud of the work.
That's fantastic. You know, so your writing is spanning a lot of different topics, but really kind of just bringing to the surface a lot of information that isn't really well known, it seems, if I was to look at your three works and find a common thread.
Sure. This is actually my number one advice for fledgling authors. Find a familiar topic, but put your own spin on it. Look at it from a different angle, a very unique angle. And when you do that, the people will be more than willing to buy your books.
That's a really, really great advice. How has been the whole writing and publishing process been for you?
Well, you know, there are highs and lows, but for me, it's been really amazing. Not long ago, I believed that to get a book published, you had to have attended Harvard University or something like that. But I've always loved to write, and you know, I can't seem to stop it. Sometimes it seems very, very addictive, but I've been extraordinarily lucky. I've received two publishing contracts. I never ever thought I would get one. And
that's fantastic for a first author. I mean, really, that's remarkable. So you're obviously putting out some very well-written work and work that people want to read. So that says something.
Yeah.
You're going to have a long career.
Oh, well, thank you. That's what I'm hoping for. But I've been so pleasantly surprised. I never thought I would get an agent, but I finally got an agent. I never thought that I would get a blurb from a best-selling author, but I did that. I didn't think I would get good reviews, but the reviews have been actually really, really good.
They've been fantastic. I've read a number of them on Amazon and then a few in some other places, but I mean, really, it is quite remarkable. You really are getting some fantastic feedback.
Sure. You know, you strive for excellence.
There
you do the best that you can.
Yeah, absolutely, and it pays off.
Okay. Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Jonathan. It's been wonderful talking about you, talking with you. Even though we've been considering a very, very heavy subject here, it is all information that is fascinating and really needs to be shared and made public.
Needs to be told.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Jonathan. Let's have you back when you come out with Piltdown Man and Other Hoaxes next year. And
wonderful.
All the best.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Take care, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
All right, listeners, that's been Jonathan Maxwell in his fantastic first book, Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites and the Nazi SS, is on shelves now, just been published, available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books in Print, and his publisher's website, pdbookstore.com. I know Jonathan is in the process of getting his own personal website made up. So at this point, you can go read some reviews on Amazon and just Google him. You'll find him around the web and maybe stumble upon his new website if it's up. So I want to thank you for tuning into this very interesting interview today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Do check out for Murderous Intellectuals. And so until next time, I'm Juanita Watson. You've been listening to Inside Scoop Live. Until next time.